Welcome back to Tuesdays with Tim, the podcast that touches on all things related to brain injuries among children and those who've been impacted by my son, Luke. Today's guest is Ashley Michael. Ashley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tim. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's just start out with the day that I know that you'll never forget. I wish you could. March 25th, 2017.
Yes. So March 25th, 2017 is... It's funny, we actually kind of like talk about that, like that day is like before accident, after accident. Like it's kind of like a kind of litmus of timeline. And Joel and I had just celebrated 10 years of marriage in January and decided we wanted to renew our vows and rented a little bed and breakfast, had invited a guest list of people, and were preparing to have everyone show up. It was a Saturday afternoon. We had done opening day ceremony for Louisa Little League. And so we had a friend that was sitting at the bed and breakfast with us while I was decorating tables and putting food together and all of those things, just keeping an eye on the kiddos. And we had Luke, who is at the time, just turned 2 year old, very curious, very wild little boy. And she, the individual that was watching him, ended up just losing track, as sometimes this happens with toddlers. Joel had ran to get some ice and came back and asked where Luke was. And then when we realized that she had no idea, frantically searched all around the property. I immediately thought he's run into the parking lot. He's went into traffic, because I knew that we had guests that were going to be arriving soon, and could not find him. And then we heard the shrill scream of a child saying, "He's in the water," and found him floating in a koi pond that was directly next to the bed and breakfast, very obscurely hidden with like some overgrown grass, but no type of security feature, you know, to keep children out or animals out of it. And really, we were like, didn't even know it was there, had no clue that this little koi pond was there because it was so hidden by the overgrowth. And when Joel jumped into the water to grab him, we were quite shocked when it was literally waist deep. So lots of questions about how this was there, why this was there, why there was no guard around it. But that was kind of the last thing on our mind at that point. And we got him out of the water. I immediately started doing CPR on him. All I kept thinking was his lungs are full of water, so there's no point in trying to breathe in them. But if I can at least just do CPR on his heart and get his heart to start beating again, called the Orange County Fire and EMS, which happened to be directly across the street from us. We were very blessed in that regard. And they got there in probably 5 minutes or so and immediately took over, intubated him, put him into the back of the bus, and just told us to wait while they did what they could do. They came out probably 15 minutes in to let us know that they had gotten his heart to start beating again, but it was super inconsistent and it would stop and then it would come back and then it would stop. And it was in the low 40s to 60s, very bradycardic. And then they ended up telling us they were calling in Pegasus, which is our life flight helicopter for UVA hospital. And I know other people would be really scared about that, but that was actually the first moment of hope that I had, because I knew if they're calling in the helicopter, they at least think they can get him to the hospital. Like they at least feel like there's enough to get him there. And so the helicopter landed, they came and worked on him and ended up coming out to tell us that he was still unstable enough that they did not feel comfortable putting him in the chopper, that they were going to bus him to a local hospital, not a level one trauma center like UVA, but a local one, to at least get him stable enough that then they would fly him over to UVA hospital. I jumped in the front of the ambulance. The paramedic from the helicopter ended up staying in the ambulance because they were having to rotate how many people were doing CPR on him. And they had bagged him. We get into our trip, it was probably 20 minutes to that hospital. And I just remember I was holding his little blue tennis shoes, his little blue sneakers in my hand that he had been wearing that day, just praying that, and each prayer was very specific, like just get his heart going again. Just get this doing. So that way it was, I didn't want to just say, save him. Like, well, we wanted him to be saved, but I needed to be very specific. I needed God to know that we were focusing on one thing at a time, one step. And we pull into Culpeper Hospital. And as we're pulling in, they don't even go to the ER because the medic screams, nope, go straight to the helipad. We've got him stable enough. So they pull right over to the helipad. Pegasus had already landed. We put him in there. I get into the cockpit. In the passenger seat, I guess. I don't even know if that's what it's called in a helicopter. And rode the 17-minute flight from Culpeper to land on the top of UVA. And then they just, the ER doctors and nurses were waiting at the top of the hospital with us, whisked us down straight to the emergency room. And they put us into, you know, one of their trauma level one rooms. And there was a little yellow box that was taped off in the middle of the room. And that's where I had to stand. They're like, mom, you can stay in here, but you cannot leave this box. I was like, oh, okay. And I just sat there feeling so helpless, just watching all. And I mean, it was tens of people working on him because they had a respiratory therapist. They had the attending doctors. They had a PICU doc come down, multiple nurses. They put a bear hugger on him, all of the things. I remember watching him. He started posturing, which at the time I didn't realize what that was. So I actually thought it was a good thing. And I was like, oh, good. He's moving. Mm-hmm. And I could tell by their eyes, like, that's not good. This isn't good for him to be doing that. They get him stable enough. They get the field tube out and put like a more permanent type, at least temporary permanent intubation in him. And they get him at least stable enough that he's at like his heart rate's in the 80s. And they're able to bag him, get him up to the PICU. They don't let us go back initially, make us stay in the waiting room. The doc comes out and just tells us that it doesn't matter what they're doing. His FiO2 is at 100%. His PEEP, which is the pressure that they were putting into the breathing machine to keep his lungs inflated, was at a 21. And he's like, it's as high as we can go. If we go any higher, we're going to pop his lungs. And he was like, and even with all of that, he is only statting in the 40s and 50s. Like he's not doing well. He's very sick and we don't think he's going to make it. So we are recommending that he get something called ECMO. And he's like, we've had the ped surge team come in. They're going to get him downstairs, do the surgery, but we really don't know that he'll survive the surgery. So we're going to let you guys come back and see him before we take him downstairs. It's like, okay.
Let me just stop you there. You know, here is now supposed to be the renewal of Val's 10-year anniversary, and you go from the ambulance to the helicopter to the news that you may be seeing your son for the last time.
Yes.
You know, and I've been through some of those types of emotions, but for you, did you have the sense that, no, he's going to make it?
Yes. And I know that sounds bizarre because no one else did. No one did. But I had that calm. It was actually when they asked us to come back. And I mean, at that point, it was only 7 o'clock. His accident happened at 4. It was 3 hours of just like this complete whirlwind. And when they asked us to come back, I'm like, no. He's not leaving here, not tonight at least. And I'm like, God, you wouldn't do this. Like, why would you let us get him back and then rip him right back away from us? This isn't okay. But trusting also, if this is the plan, I'm going to follow it, but I don't like it very much right now. And it was just that weird of like incomplete shock that is this like truly, I was at one point wondering, is this really happening? Is this a dream? Am I going to wake up? And then knowing like, no, this is your life. And then you have those swath of, oh my gosh, I've got these other children. And I didn't even know where they were at that point. I knew someone had them. I think my mom had taken them. But being faced with these decisions and I'm like, all I wanted to know today was like whether I was going to eat one or two slices of wedding cake. Now I'm having to make decisions as to whether my son should go under this surgery to potentially save his life, but could potentially end it if we elect to do it too.
So take me to the next step, the next moments.
So we walk back down the little corridor of the PICU into his room. And of course, in a PICU, it's individualized rooms. And there's a nurse there. Her name, she went by Mama. That's what everyone called her, Mama. And, you know, she brings me over, tells me, like, you know, I don't want to touch here, but you can kiss him. You can do this. You can whisper in his ear. I'm like, oh, okay. And we lean down and I just start talking to him. And at that point, again, his, like, everything's beeping because his saturation levels are so low and his heart rate is so low that it's they won't even stop issuing the warnings. They're like, nope, this is terrible. And as I start talking to him and just put my hand on his hand, all of a sudden his saturation rates start to come up. And we keep talking to him. I'm not really even paying attention, but I just notice the room starts to get quiet and they're watching him and they're watching the monitor. And all of a sudden he's going from 40% and 50% saturations. Now he's in the 70s and then he was in the 80s and then he was in the low 90s.
So what he needed, Ashley, then was to hear his mom.
Exactly. And that's exactly what the nurse said. Like the PICU doctor looks up and he goes, what the hell just happened? And nurse Mama goes, he just needed his mom. Mm-hmm. And ped surge came in and said, well, he's not a candidate anymore. We're not going to do ECMO on this boy. He's saturating fine. So we're going to let it ride. And that was when I knew, like, he's not going to leave us right now. I knew that our life was going to look exponentially different, but I knew that it wasn't going to be because it was absent of Luke.
How many days, weeks, months did you spend there in the hospital?
So it was a two-part. We were at UVA in the PICU for 30 days. Spent 30 days, correction. We spent 28, but 25 of them were in the PICU. And then they moved us to the intermediate floor, the IMU, where we picked up like a floor nurse who had extra patients. Like, we celebrated because, hey, he's not the sickest kid here right now. We can actually move and have other kids, a nurse assigned to multiple children, not just Luke. Because for quite a bit of that time, it was just Luke. And then we left there immediately and went straight to the Kennedy Krieger Institute, which is the inpatient pediatric rehabilitation center for Johns Hopkins up in Baltimore. So that was about a 2.5-3 hour trek from home to be there. It's interesting, when we were in the PICU, even still, you think, like, we're out of the woods, and everyone thought, oh, because he's at the hospital, he's going to be fine. Everything's fine. And I remember it was like day three that night, he had seizures in the morning. I noticed them. I pointed them out. They ended up coming in and doctors were like, nope, that's exactly what it is, Mom. Good catch. And like, I'd never seen a seizure before in my life, but just the rhythmic patterns that he was doing was really bizarre to me. So I'm glad we were there, that we could pick them out. But they came in, they had done his MRI that morning, and we're going to go over it with us the next day. And they sent a different attending physician in because they had one each night, Dr. Spader, who is the kindest man, but man, what a terrible job he had, because he had to have the quality versus quantity talk with me and Joel. And we're just sitting there on the side of this little couch watching this little baby when he comes in and starts talking to us about, hey, I know that he is doing okay right now, but you need to understand that the child that you had 3 days ago is not going to be the child that you would walk out of this hospital with. And you may end up with a trach. You could end up with a feeding tube. You could end up with a child who is completely minimally conscious for the rest of his life. And that is a lot of work. And that is very heavy and very taxing on families. You could have a child that has significant medical challenges and needs that may far exceed what you are able and capable of providing to him. And you know, we definitely are going to do whatever we can to keep him here, but you need to also think through, is that what is best for Luke? It might be best for you right now because you feel like you need to do everything to fight for him, but is that what's best for him?
You know, hearing this and the irony, I guess, is that, you know, you have a Luke and I had Luke and I heard the exact same thing. And even at the very end for us, Jenny had said to me, what's best for Luke, because of his quality of life, may not be what's best for the two of us. But I have, of course, have seen Luke, in Austin at therapies. And if you could kind of fast forward now, 7 years later, tell me how Luke is doing, how the family is doing. And before you tell me that, tell me the ages of all of your children.
So we have a 16-year-old girl. She's the oldest and the only girl. And then we have a 14-year-old boy and a 13-year-old boy. And then our Luke just turned 9 in February. And it's interesting, Tim, because Jenny and I were on the same page and Joel was not. When I said what may be best for Luke, and he was like, oh no, we will do whatever it takes. And I was like, babe, I don't know about that. Like, we need to talk about this. And he was like, no, we will figure it out. And no one could have predicted then what we would end up with now. Luke, of course, still has significant challenges and needs. But he is the happiest. I think he might be the happiest person on the planet. I truly, when I look at someone's quality of life, this is a kid who gets to go to school every day for a couple of hours, not a full day. His dad is home with him. My husband, you know, made the ultimate sacrifice and selflessness of giving up his entire career to stay home and care for this child. He has siblings that adore him, that because of his challenges, he has made them more empathetic, compassionate, kind, thoughtful little human beings.
Yes, yes, I understand that.
And he has just a community of people, and he's been able to impact so many others with his story. And he is now eating on his own. We left with a feeding tube on at least a half a dozen different medications. He was legally blind. Like, he wasn't even reacting to light at that point. To now, he is starting to mimic words again and crawls all over the place, likes to hold hands and walk. He does need assistance with the walking, but he's getting there. And just most importantly is joyful. Like, he challenges and humbles me every day that this kid has to overcome so many things just to function that I am able to do by just waking up.
You know,
but
Ashley,
he does it joyfully.
You know, Ashley, I've talked to so many parents since Team Luke Hope for Minds began in 2018. And what I have mentioned to each of them is the importance of both parents being as involved as possible, and to include siblings and include friends with the child who had the brain injury. And what I always talk about, too, is that all therapies are important. And I know you have done, from stem cell to laser therapy, you've done a lot of therapies.
Yep.
But the most important therapy that I believe that Luke has received and others has received is the love of you and Joel. Luke's parents, you two have made such an incredible difference in Luke's life. And I think love is the most important therapy. And I've seen this in talking to you over the phone, but just from afar. And so I just want to tell you how much I admire the work that both of you have put in for this, not only for Luke, but for the rest of your children.
Absolutely. And I appreciate that because it is tough. And a lot of people always think of it as like, it's Luke's disability, but it does impact our entire family. Like, even having to think through activities that we can attend, because when we were in the hospital, I remember MJ, one of the doctors, looking at us saying, Luke is still just a part of your family. He is not your whole world. And you need to make sure that you engage him in your world and you meet him where he needs to be met, but you also bring him out. So from the get-go, he was on the side of the pool when the kids started swim team that year. And we sat out for those long nights of swim practices and swim meets. And If we go to a local theme park or to the carnival, like, he's coming with us. We don't just hole him up in the house because that's, you know, where it's safe and most comfortable. We put him out of his comfort zone. But we also allow our children to understand, like, sometimes people may look, people may have questions, and we help them navigate how to answer them and how to teach other people to engage and interact with him in a meaningful, impactful way for him.
You're on your way right now to therapy.
Yeah, yeah. We're actually in Arizona right now, heading over to some functional neurology, some laser therapy. My daughter actually did a whole project on stem cell therapy for her AP Governor School class because she has seen how amazing and incredible it's been for her brother, which we have to thank you for because it was your organization that allowed us with a grant to be able to afford it the very first time. We would not have been able to do that.
I vividly remember where I was. I was driving back from Fort Worth with Luke in the van when I first talked to you on the phone. And, you know, we have similarities. Obviously, our child's name is Luke, had similar types of injury, has siblings. And I know that I did all that I could to include my daughters and Jenny, because you said something that was so profound, that Luke isn't your entire world. You have other children. And I did the best I could, but I certainly felt like I spent so much of my time with Luke. But we have one other similarity that I think I would love to share, and that we are big Saints fans. And of course, everyone that follows our story knows about the Saints and our love of the Saints and Drew Brees and what the organization means to us. Why and how did you become a Saints fan?
So it's so funny because I don't live anywhere near Louisiana. I'm in Central Virginia, but I took French in middle school and we were learning about different Francophone areas of the world and our country. And they start talking about New Orleans and Louisiana and just the culture and the people. I was like, these are my people. Like, this is where I need to be. We like to eat. We like good jazz and blues. And then I learned about the Saints being the team of Louisiana. And I was like, that's my football team. My family were diehard Dallas Cowboys fans and I wanted no parts of that. So stepped out on a limb by myself and became an individual contributor of Saints fans in Virginia. And I just remember when they won their Super Bowl, it was me and one other person rooting for them. And they came out and did that onside kick at halftime, which was the craziest thing I've ever seen in my life. And I was like, this is my team right here. This is why I love them.
Well, that's why I knew I loved you from the start. By the way, I was at that game and I'll never forget that. But, you know, the Saints, the organization has been so wonderful for Luke. And I'm sure in some ways, you know, the New Orleans Saints and sports in general has helped you and your family. You know, Ashley, I just want to tell you how much I admire what you have done for Luke. And my last question for you is how the dynamic with you and Joel, how has that been? Because I know that is a subject that comes up a lot. And unfortunately, in our case, Luke's passing affected our marriage. And we, Jay and I, although getting along very, very well, got divorced last summer. And I just want to know how you and Joel are doing.
Yeah, that is a great question. it definitely was difficult, especially right at first, because I had my way of managing grief. And people don't get that when you have a child that suffers this traumatic event and they're like, oh, but he's still with you. He's still home. And I'm like, but is he? Like, his body is here. But I now have like the blessing of, we've got an opportunity to do what we can, but it's also not lost on me the things that we will miss out on. Like who he taken to prom, who would have potentially become his spouse if he would have had children, you know, what this future expected that is now gone. And it is replaced with other beautiful things, finding the joy in, you know, what is it? Welcome to Holland, like finding the joy in the tulips when you were expecting to go to Italy. And we do try to focus on that, but we also try to give each other space to be sad about the things that we have every reason and every legitimate right to be sad about. But Joel handles it very differently than I do. I tend to be a, you know, pretty positive person. I'd like to joke around, things like that. And that was not where he was at, especially at the hospital. And it actually took a doctor sitting down with us and saying, you cannot expect them to be at the same place as you, because your grief is going to look different, and you have to give space and you have to respect that about one another. And so we try to talk through, you know, there's moments when we're having just a really low down moment, but it is definitely hard. Your dynamic changes completely. And for us, going from two income family to a single income family, you know, Joel being the primary caregiver, that's always an interesting topic, because some people have well-meaning jokes and fun, but sometimes don't realize like how kind of rash and harsh it can be. Jokes about dad being home with kiddo, and like, no, he's doing incredible work. So I make sure that I'm super defensive of him in moments like that, because I know, and you know, being that caregiver for Luke, there is no harder job in the world that you're not. It's different than just raising a neurotypical child, because you are changing the diaper of a kid that should have been potty trained years ago. You are feeding a child who should be able to feed themselves. You're eating your food cold or not at all, because your entire world is devoted to making sure that their needs, not even their wants, that their needs are met. And so I try to really keep that into perspective, that the work that Joel does is never ending, and it is 24 hours on, 7 days a week. And I appreciate him tremendously for it. There have been times that I've had to have the come into like, hey, you know, I know that this is really important for Luke, but we need to take a break. Like he needs a break from therapy. He needs a break from this. We just need to have time as a family unit and not be on the road doing stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he'll push back healthily, and be like, well, no, he needs these things. I'm like, he doesn't, he's okay. Like, we're good. But it is hard. And we've seen a lot of families who still love each other deeply, but just, you know, trying to overcome that is difficult.
Well, the respect I have for both of you, and I admire Joel, because I was Joel, and mm-hmm. You know, and I'm just so grateful that Team Luke Hofer Minds was there to help you, and we will always be here for you and your family. And I just want to tell you how much I love your attitude and your energy and your positivity. So all the best to you and your family, and look forward to keeping in touch, and also looking forward to cheering on our Saints this season.
Yes.
So all the best.
Think it's going to be a good season.
I hope so. Thanks again, Ashley, and take care.
Thank you, Tim.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.